Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with a doctor about the role that inflammation plays in heart disease, its detection, and treatment options. Jay will also speak with experts about educational savings plans and about prostate cancer. Plus, Angela Ann of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Fall is the perfect time for a health reset. And doctors say it's time to look beyond cholesterol. Inflammation is a hidden risk that could trigger a heart attack. Even people with normal cholesterol levels, many don't even know they're at risk. Dr. Andrew Freeman is the Director of Cardiovascular Prevention and Wellness at the National Jewish Health Organization. He says inflammation plays a critical role in cardiovascular disease. And he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So first of all, let's define inflammation. What does that mean?
So inflammation is an important thing in many cases, right? So if you get a cut or you break a bone or you get hurt, you want inflammation to kind of surge and really foster the healing process. But it's really the chronic low-grade inflammation that is really dangerous. And that comes from a lot of poor living habits, things like obesity or physical inactivity or eating highly processed foods. Many people don't realize it, but they're walking around with low-grade inflammation, but it's easily measured if we want to do it.
How does one measure low-grade inflammation?
Pretty easily. We do a blood test. So when your doctor does your cholesterol panel or whatever other blood work they might be doing, they just need to throw on what's called a high sensitivity C-reactive protein, or CRP for short. And it is a very readily available, easily measured number. And when we see that people are chronically inflamed, we usually need to work on lifestyle and then intensify some of the medicines that we use. In fact, we even have a new medication that's not even that new, believe it or not. It's been around since ancient Egypt, and it's originally derived from crocus flowers, believe it or not. But it is called low-dose colchicine, which is FDA-approved and requires a prescription. But it actually lowers inflammation so well that it affords about a 31% risk reduction on top of things like statins, like we usually use.
How does one know if one would qualify for such an antidote?
Really, they just need to talk with their doctor and see what their risk is and have them measure that high sensitivity C-reactive protein. But an even more potent antidote, and especially in the season of change when we're focusing on improving ourselves, would be probably to switch one's lifestyle, which is probably even harder. And synergistically, the medication and the lifestyle together are really powerful. And if it's okay, I'll jump into just a very brief. There are five quick things that I tell all of my patients every single day to do.
We are standing at the ready.
All right, sounds good. First is exercise. And a lot of people underestimate it, but it is an incredibly powerful tool. I call it the fountain of youth. But you have to drink from it in order for it to work. And so 30 minutes of brisk, breathless activity every day, truly magical. Of course, check with your doctor first. Second is diet. And this one is the hardest, especially for your listeners in the Midwest. I did some medical training in Buffalo, so not terribly far. But that diet has to change.
And oh, God, you've been to the Anchor Bar, so you know the problem.
I do. And I would say it needs to switch to a predominantly low-fat, whole-food, plant-based diet. So get out those air-fried cauliflower wings instead of the normal buffalo wings if you can do it. But it turns out that if you can eat this way, all of the evidence to date actually suggests marked reductions in inflammation, heart disease, cancer, and even diabetes. Third is stress. We live in an incredibly stressful time, and we need to spend time every day, meditate, watch the sunrise, do some yoga, try to cast off that stress. Fourth is sleeping enough. Most of us don't get enough sleep. The goal is 7 to 9 hours a night of uninterrupted sleep. And if we can do that, that's associated with the least amount of heart disease. And last but certainly not least, and a lot of people will get a kick out of this, but it turns out the people who have the most love and support in their lives actually have the best heart outcomes. So you always want to strengthen relationships with people that matter and maybe get rid of those that aren't so good. So those five things together, eating plants, exercising more, stressing less, loving more, and sleeping enough, will do more for you than any doctor ever has, and it's absolutely free. And then when you combine it with great medications like statins and low-dose colchicine, you really can set up a milieu that makes heart disease hard to creep in.
What do you mean by exercise?
So exercise is, a lot of people think that, what they do in their everyday job is enough. And of course that's good, but it's probably not good enough. I want people to get 30 minutes a day of breathless physical activity. So if you go with your partner, your spouse, your friend, they should be able to talk to you and you should be unable to talk back. So it's good for your relationship and your body, believe it or not. But if you can get that level in check and make sure you check with your doctor first, you can really do some amazing things to lower blood pressure, reduce weight, and of course, reduce inflammation.
So going back to the role that inflammation plays, how does it negatively impact heart disease and how could it possibly lead to a heart attack?
Yeah, so the root cause of every single disease we suffer from is inflammation. And what I just gave your listeners was a recipe to put their bodies into an anti-inflammatory environment. But inflammation is what is the amplifier for heart disease. In fact, just to get technical, that C-reactive protein that I talked about actually outpredicts things like LDL, the bad cholesterol, when it comes to figuring out who's having a heart attack or not. So if we can figure out how to treat the inflammation, we usually can figure out how to reduce all sorts of diseases, if that makes sense.
And how likely are the insurance companies to pay for the anti-inflammatory treatment?
It's totally variable, and I believe the manufacturer has set up a number of programs so that it's quite inexpensive. And in general, most people can get it, especially if they have a higher C-reactive protein.
So for folks that want to do a deep dive on this subject and want to learn more, what is a good layman's website to send them to?
Yeah, there's probably two that I recommend. One is called CVD Inflammation. That's C as in cat, V as in Victor, D as in dog, inflammation.com. And the other is the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. Just Google it. There's a treasure trove of lifestyle modification resources on there that are really, really powerful. And those two together are excellent resources.
And how long have you been practicing?
I've been in practice for 16 years.
And in that time, how many people have you helped save lives with regard to this prescription?
Well, I don't know the exact number, but I guess what I would tell you is first, when people make lifestyle changes, it's like new people come into the office. And for the people that are able to make a lot of lifestyle changes, sometimes I can't even recognize them. And then in terms of using low-dose colchicine, I've been using it for several years now, and the results are really extraordinary. I mean, it makes C-reactive protein plummet, and it reduces the inflammatory state, and it creates that health-promoting milieu that we're looking for.
I would certainly think that everyone ought to look into this. We want to thank Dr. Andrew Freeman for being our guest today, and for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
With school back in session, many families here in Central Ohio are considering how they will pay for future education costs. There's a new study from Edward Jones and Morning Consult shows that only 38% of Americans feel like they're saving enough to meet their educational goals. Julia Bartok, financial advisor with Edward Jones, joins us now on Columbus Perspective to shed some light on what's causing this and what can be done about it. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We're glad to have you. How are people feeling about their education savings right now?
You know, when I talk with families, one of the most common concerns is education, whether it's saving for college, private school, or even advanced training later on. And the truth is, many people don't feel very confident in this area. A recent survey found that only about 2 in 5 Americans believe they're saving enough to reach their education goals. And it makes sense. Most households are balancing competing priorities. You've got groceries, childcare, retirement planning, maybe trying to buy a home. And on top of that, you're expected to fund education. So it can feel overwhelming. But here's the key. It's never too early and it's never too late.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Every contribution matters. So starting, being diligent, having a plan in place, working together with a financial advisor to make sure you understand your goals and what you want to fund for education for kids, And whether you can set aside a large amount or just something small, even modest, consistent contributions can grow significantly over time.
So explain to me what the 529 plan is.
Yeah, 529 plan, it's one of the most flexible, powerful tools out there. It's specifically designed for education. So the money you put in grows tax-free. And then when it's used for qualified education expenses, that would be things like books, tuition, or housing, you don't pay taxes when you withdraw it. And that's a huge advantage.
My question to you is, can I take money out of my paycheck, not be taxed for it, and put it into a 529? Or am I still subject to taxation on that contribution? Does it operate the same way as an IRA?
So it's a little different. Some states have special tax benefits to doing it or to contributing. And I've heard of some companies that allow you to contribute through payroll, but I would say most go through a financial advisor where you can directly partner with someone to understand your specific goals and needs. So it would be a little different from an IRA contribution.
What happens if we're saving for college tuition and let's say our child decides college isn't for them? What do we do with that money?
Mm-hmm. That's something I hear a lot. What if I save all this money and my child doesn't use it? The good news is that 529s are very flexible. If one child decides not to pursue college, you can transfer the account to another child or even a future grandchild. If your child earns a scholarship, you can withdraw that equivalent amount without the usual penalty. And with the new rules that came out with the Secure Act 2.0, unused funds can even now be rolled into a Roth IRA for the beneficiary, of course, subject to certain criteria. So it's not a locked-in situation. You're not going to just lose the money if life takes a different path. You still have options to keep those funds working for your family's benefit.
Now, is there any differentiation between, say, a community college, a technical school, or an actual university?
A lot of families don't realize just how broad the list of qualified expenses is. So it's not just tuition anymore. Like you said, 529 funds can also be used for K through 12 tuition, apprenticeship programs, even now paying down student loans. And some states, like we talked about earlier, offer those additional tax benefits if you use their state-sponsored plan.
I remember, and I'm as old as a dinosaur, but I remember when I went to college, tuition was rather affordable, but beyond tuition, there were living expenses associated with going to college. Does the 529 plan allow for usage of those funds for, say, rent, clothes, transportation, school supplies?
Yeah, the list's pretty broad on what you can use it for. It would be things like housing. I'm not sure on clothing or transportation, but I do know books, tuition. It's honestly really flexible. It's really broad. And that is where a financial advisor comes into play. We can really help with sitting down, understanding your goals, your specific needs, and really putting a plan together that matches that.
What do you guys do in the case of a situation where a family has more than one child? And let's say one child is going to become a doctor, but the other one wants to become a plumber. Obviously, it's not the same path, doesn't require the same amount of money. How does that work?
Yeah, families often will ask me, do I need a separate 529 for each child? The answer is, honestly, it depends. Some parents like the simplicity of one account per child. It helps them track contributions and know exactly what's been set aside for each one. And actually, our research found that a little under half of families with multiple kids do exactly that. But others prefer to keep one large account and simply just change the beneficiary as needed, which that's an option also built into 529s that can give you the flexibility. Let's say one child's path is more expensive than another's. There's no single right answer. It really comes down to your strategy and comfort level. And it's important to also revisit your plan regularly because education costs change, family circumstances change, and your saving strategy should adapt right alongside with you.
Some people who are listening may find this conversation overwhelming and not remember half the stuff we discussed today. So where can we send them via the internet to learn more and in layman's terms?
Yeah, the easiest place to start is edwardjones.com/education savings. So there you can read about 529 plans and other strategies, and also find a local Edward Jones financial advisor near you. We also offer some free modules through our financial fitness program as well. So they're just short, accessible lessons that can help your kids or teens or even adults build financial knowledge.
Now, I know you work for Edward Jones, and obviously you're predisposed to Edward Jones, but Edward Jones isn't the only financial planning service out there that does this, correct?
Correct. Yep. I would say most large wirehouse firms will offer 529 plans.
All right. We want to thank Julia Bartok from Edward Jones for joining us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Prostate cancer is the most frequently diagnosed cancer among men in Ohio. In a recent survey period, the Ohio Department of Health reported an average of over 8,000 new prostate cancer cases diagnosed each year right here in the Buckeye State. Half of those cases came from central Ohio. Bob Lane, prostate cancer survivor and advocate known as Elevator Bob, we'll get into that later, and Dr. Benjamin Lowentritt, director of prostate cancer services at United Urology Group, join us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for sure.
Dr. Lowentritt, what are some types of prostate cancer that are lesser known?
Yeah, and thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be here partnering with Johnson & Johnson to talk through this. And you mentioned it in your opening that when we're considering more advanced prostate cancer, so cancer that has spread or recurred after treatment, we're really need to consider if it is hormone sensitive or not. And that hormone we're talking about here is testosterone. Testosterone is the fuel that feeds prostate cancer. And we can leverage this in our treatments by restricting the ability of that testosterone to feed the cancer. So we have a number of treatments like ERLEADA that actually do that and can put the cancer into a dormant state, oftentimes for years if we identify it. But it really is only if it's still in that hormone-sensitive stage overall. So I think it's really important when patients are, you know, finding out about their disease that they're understanding whether they're at this stage and they can discuss the risks and benefits of different treatments with their doctor and care team.
We've heard recently about treatments for low testosterone. Is there a high testosterone issue? And what role does the testosterone play in treating the condition?
It's a great question. So we don't actually think that testosterone, high levels of testosterone, cause prostate cancer. But just normal levels of testosterone, the prostate itself is a hormone-sensitive organ. What it's supposed to be doing in the body and how it helps with reproduction is testosterone-dependent. But unfortunately, the way that the cancer works is that the testosterone does impact that as well and continues to feed the growth of the cancer that in the whole definition of cancer is it's essentially growth that's no longer controlled by the normal mechanisms. So we don't certainly want to typically give testosterone to most of these patients. We are trying to restrict both the production of testosterone and then the ability of any remaining testosterone to act on the prostate cancer because that will make it grow more quickly.
Now, Bob, you survived prostate cancer. What kind of prostate cancer did you have? What stage were you when it was diagnosed? And what was your treatment journey like?
My treatment journey, my stages, originally when it was found, it was technically stage three, when it was found and removed surgically because it had spread to the seminal vesicles, which are nearby organs next to the prostate. So technically it was called stage three, and they thought they got it all, but it did come back 3 years later. We're checking every 90 days to see if it does come back, and sure enough, we found it. And for 4 years we watched, and then finally we were able to locate it in my C1 vertebrae up between my brain and my spinal cord. But then we took it out with radiation, and during those 4 years, I had the conversations for on and off for 4 years about different treatment options, because during those 4 years we knew it was sensitive, as Dr. Lowenfield was just speaking. So we had the good fortune that it was sensitive to hormone treatment. So we quickly decided and fairly decided over the 4 years to go with a combination therapy that included the Erleada, because it was basically state-of-the-art, and it continues to perform exactly very, very well. I'm 4.5 years out on that journey and show no signs of negativity. I carry my own golf bag. I'm to all the world, I'm not a cancer patient. And technically, once it spreads, once it metastasizes, it's called stage four. And that's not the same connotation, possibly, as Dr. can get into this a little bit, with some of the other cancers that we're all familiar with. Stage four just means that it's spread outside of the cavity. It doesn't mean that it's a death sentence by any stretch of the imagination.
So how'd you get the nickname Elevator Bob?
Elevator Bob, that's a good question, and a moniker that I'm happy to have. The head nurse asked me one day if I thought it would be a good idea for men who are coming out of the advanced prostate cancer clinic every Monday and every Thursday, if they had someone to speak with who has been through it, and through the surgery, and through the radiation, and through the hormone treatment. And I said, yeah, it'd be a good idea. And she asked me 15 seconds later, same question, and I said, well, you're not asking my opinion, are you? He said, no. Well, I said, sure, I'm in. So I do that every, 2 days a week. I sit out by the elevator. It's a little lobby area, just me and my table of information. So the patients see me when they come in, smile, say hello. Well, on their way out, I don't approach anybody unless they approach me first, because nobody wants to be approached by a stranger. Not when they're talking about this, not when they just learned maybe 15 minutes ago that they had it. But if they approach me, you come up with different ways for them to approach me. Then I can open up a conversation with them and actually speak with them about different options that might be available, information basically, for them to go back to their care team, to go back to their doctor with, questions for the doctor. From well-vetted sources, whether it's prostate cancer, their zeroprostate.com, or whether it's Alita.com, or whether it's the Mayo Clinic, or whether it's MD Anderson. I share information with them that's well-vetted and allow them to help make more informed decisions for themselves.
Dr. Lowenfield, does Bob's story constitute what you call real-world evidence? I mean, he's got his elevator pitch by the elevator. You can't get more accurate than that.
I think Bob's personal story is really, really powerful, and I think that, you know, our patients are some of our best messengers on this. But when we're talking about true real-world evidence, we're actually looking at a much broader number of patients. It's a way to understand how hundreds or thousands of patients are doing across regular, everyday clinical practice, and that information can be added to what we get from our traditional clinical trials. The clinical trials are much more controlled, and then generally are what are done before a drug is available for general use. But after it's been approved, real-world evidence now has become a really important part in helping us understand how these medications are being used in everyday practice. And, you know, given that there are so many choices and there's so much individual information that we need to know, oftentimes the real-world evidence is much it really helps add to that clinical trial evidence to when doctors and patients are considering how to choose an option, right? I mean, it's always important to understand the risks and benefits and to talk to the doctors about that.
and the real world evidence can answer questions that the clinical trials often don't, that may help in making a particular choice about which treatment, like ERLEADA, that you might want to use, because we can draw on the experience of many patients across many different locations.
So when we think about that empirical evidence and all of those patients, is there a really good website that you could recommend where patients go to examine these options in layman's terms?
I think Bob was talking about it. I see, you know, going to ERLEADA.com, that's ERLEADA.com, you can understand more about that treatment and the risks and benefits. I always think it's very important to go to your doctor or to find a specialist that understands prostate cancer if you're feeling like you need to hear more about that. There are other websites. There's the Urology Care Foundation and a number of the resources that are out there for people to understand more about their prostate cancer. And then, you know, I do encourage everyone to get screened and to talk to your doctor about that early diagnosis, which still is very, very key. But if you are affected by the disease and if it is advancing, to really delve into more information about ERLEADA and other similar treatments.
Now, Bob, I'm also a cancer survivor, a different type of cancer, and I know firsthand that attitude is everything. What did you do in terms of social and emotional support, and where can you send the listeners who might be needing that side of the equation?
Well, congratulations to you first, Jay. That's good news on your diagnosis, and you're ahead of the curve there.
Thank you.
What I try to do is let folks know that they're not alone. They're not alone at all, and to build a network and actually build it of healthcare professionals, of family members, of patients, fellow patients. You're going to learn from every one of those groups information. A lot of that information you can share with your family members, which is going to help put their minds at ease, and that's part of the whole thing, because people hear the C word and they don't want to talk about it. So, right. So it's important to be able to get as much information as you can and put those family members' minds at ease somewhat. Online organizations, we've spoken. There's peer groups available for patients to speak with and tap into. I mentioned Zero Prostate Cancer has, I think, about 165 different peer groups. They also have one-on-one counseling available for people. And it's the list goes on. There's all kinds of information available. But the key, as Dr. Lohenthal was just saying, is you got to get tested early, because you have options if you get tested early. If you find it early, you can deal with it, and it's not going to be a life or death issue. 99% cure rate, early diagnosis, 34% if it's found too late. So it's an easy decision to make.
Absolutely. We want to thank Elevator Bob Lane for being with us, and also Dr. Benjamin Lohenthal. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Angela Ann from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
We begin with the battle over Ohio's political maps. The map process has been drawn out many times, creating confusion in Ohio. After a very short meeting that barely made it to 30 minutes, state leaders still do not have an agreement on a bipartisan map. Well, here's Face the State host Doug Petkash walking us through what happened this time around as both sides face a critical deadline.
The map we have put forward represents a fair constitutional proposal.
Democrats once again testified in support of the congressional district map they proposed that would create 8 districts that favor Republicans and 7 that favor Democrats. Under the current map, Republicans hold 10 of the state's 15 seats in Congress. So far, Republicans have not proposed a map.
Is there any map from Republicans forthcoming?
Well, I think there's discussions ongoing and have been actually for, frankly, weeks between leadership of the Republican Party and leadership of the Democratic Party. If those discussions start to bear fruit, I think you'll see a map here in this commission. But I think the ball is kind of in the Democrats' court to decide, you know, what deal they are or are not willing to take.
Democrats accuse the Republicans of dragging their feet.
If it's slow walk through the month of October, It leads to November, when the Republican majority can just pass a map of their own with only their members voting.
That's not true. We're following the process.
Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio suggested Democrats may ask voters to repeal any map Republican lawmakers might pass in November. She says she spoke with U.S. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries about that possibility. Ohio House Minority Leader Dunny Isaacson said there is national enthusiasm for such a referendum in Ohio.
I think people are fired up by the prospect of getting access to fair maps that they deserve.
I mean, obviously, that's a consideration when we're deciding. You know, both sides have pros and cons, depending which road you want to go down. Seeing no objections, can I get a motion to adjourn?
The commission did not take public comment. When the meeting ended after only 28 minutes, many in the audience expressed their displeasure.
If the commission does not pass a bipartisan map by Friday, October 31st, the process will go back to the General Assembly, where Republicans could pass a map with no support from the Democrats. Well, now to the fight over intoxicating hemp. First, the governor banned the sale of the products, but then a judge blocked the ban. Now lawmakers are taking matters into their own hands. And this week, the Ohio House passed new age restrictions on intoxicating hemp. Governor Mike DeWine has been a strong advocate for regulations on these types of products. He says they come in all forms, gummies, cookies, even drinks. Most House lawmakers siding with the governor by a wide margin, with just 8 voting no. Here's 10TV's Kristen McFarland on the changes that this new bill is calling for.
Now, the bill includes similar language to marijuana laws with age limits, licensing requirements, and strict regulation. Many Ohio lawmakers have cited concerns that intoxicating hemp products are getting into the hands of children. Intoxicating hemp products like edibles, gummies, and other consumables with Delta 8 can often be found at vape shops and some gas stations. Governor Mike DeWine has been a strong opponent of intoxicating hemp and tried to ban sales of it earlier this month. But that ban is blocked right now in the courts. Some lawmakers are urging immediate action, while others say this bill is not ready and still needs work. The bill will now head back to the Senate. Reporting from the State House, Kristen McFarland, 10TV News.
Kristen, thank you. Now, while hemp and marijuana are both cannabis plants, hemp does not have the same effects on users. According to the Ohio Department of Agriculture, hemp is not as intoxicating. The main reason why is the different levels of THC. Federal regulations state that in order to be considered hemp, the cannabis must have less than 0.3% THC. Marijuana, on the other hand, often has THC levels over 10%. Now, there are a variety of hemp products that are not meant to be ingested, which include cosmetics, clothing, and even things like fuel and paint. Well, 2 bills at the State House could save you money on property taxes. The Ohio House passed both this week, and now they're headed to the Senate. So let's give you a closer look at those bills moving through the State House right now. House Bill 186 would limit how much school district property taxes can go up each year, keeping those increases in line with inflation. There's House Bill 335. That would put a cap on what's called inside millage. That is property tax that can be collected without a vote. Supporters say these changes will save Ohioans real money, but some school districts worry it could cut into their funding.
This amendment will cost $1.7 billion with a B per year, and we are expected to vote on this with less than an hour and a half notice when we have a finance committee convened to discuss these type of matters.
No taxpayer should have a tax increase above the rate of inflation that they haven't voted for. Period.
We have to provide the property tax layers relief.
Both bills now head to the Ohio Senate for consideration. Now, Ohio lawmakers passed a bill that would help offset a rise in energy costs. It's House Bill 15, and this will remove subsidies and give Ohio energy developers quite a boost. 10TV reporter Kevin Landers takes a closer look.
Ohio is hungry for more power.
And what we see is it's an affordability crisis.
A crisis fueled by a growing population and a growing high-tech industry.
AEP is forecasting a 50% load growth by 2030.
But there's a problem. Electric rates are on the rise, a 3% increase statewide since May, or $27 a month in the AEP territory.
Prices are one of the biggest concerns we hear.
And that concern is growing louder as the state attracts more energy consumers like data centers and their growing use of artificial intelligence.
When you see demand increase and you don't see supply correspondingly increase, any economist will tell you that's a recipe for increases in price.
Ohioans are paying more for power in part because of a limited supply of energy producers and high demand. Consumers can shop for power, but there are issues there.
I've talked to consumers who are paying two or three times more than the standard offer for their electricity because they signed up with someone who knocked on their door and they just let it ride.
And everyone else?
What does your crystal ball tell you?
The crystal ball, and I think a lot of the experts are saying, we're going to be in for some high, in the short term, for some high pricing.
To shield consumers from higher energy costs requires more supply.
So are you saying we need more power plants in Ohio?
If those forecasts are correct, we're going to need more power plants.
But can our electrical grid handle it?
The grid operators were not ready for a sharp increase.
OSU Associate Professor Noah Dormandy is an energy policy expert. He says your electric bill is impacted not only by consumption.
I'm talking about the auctions that set the retail price. That, I see, is the biggest frontier of problems for that markup that you're describing.
His research looked at millions of pages of documents over 10 years to see who is showing up to bid for the retail market.
When we see in these procurement auctions only five bidders show up in some of these auctions, when in other auctions we see 15 bidders, we have a fundamental problem.
Translation, the fewer bidders, the higher, he says, the cost of power.
When we're seeing prices on the wholesale market go from $20-something dollars to over $300 per megawatt day in our capacity markets, energy efficiency is only going to go so far.
Help is on the way. In May of this year, Governor Mike DeWine signed into law House Bill 15, which reformed the state's energy policy. One thing it did was eliminate the $1.50 subsidy for coal plants.
When those power plants lose money, those utility companies will pass those costs on to us to recover the lost revenue of those power plants.
The other thing HB 15 does is encourage in-state energy development.
If you get more supply, especially if you get more supply in Ohio, that's going to help with bills in the long run.
While turning the thermostat down a few degrees or using energy-efficient light bulbs can reduce your energy costs, market forces are also driving up costs and profits. As for consumers, experts say take control of what you can control.
Pay attention to your bill. Look at your bill every month so you can see what's happening.
So joining me now in studio is 10TV's Kevin Landers, and thank you so much for shedding light on this bill. You talked a lot about electricity in your story, but AEP right now has a case before PUCO that could really impact this bill going forward.
Yeah, so AEP has a rate case that would take effect next year, and if the Public Utilities Commission passes it, it would raise bills by about $3.20 a month, which is about a 2% increase, but that will take effect next year if it's approved.
Okay, so we'll keep our eyes on that. And it's not just electricity costs that I think that we all see that's rising. So much seems to be going up. We're also talking natural gas prices. Those are on the rise, too?
Natural gas prices are on the rise. Some people in Ohio have seen their bills go up by about 40%. What's the cause of that? Well, it costs more to generate that power. It takes more to transmit that power. Those all build into the natural gas costs, and those are likely to increase as well. So people are going to hit by electricity and also natural gas in the future. The good news, lawmakers believe, is that House Bill 15 will in the future help reduce energy costs in the state. That's going to take some time, they believe,
sure.
But they believe that's a good first step, and we'll have to see, and we'll be watching that as it progresses. And what we really need in this state is more generation power, and those take time to build.
Yeah.
That's another thing Ohio's going to have to deal with.
And look at different resources. All right,
yep.
Kevin Landers, thank you so much. Appreciate it. As the government shutdown stretches on, several local programs are being impacted. Some families are in limbo as lawmakers continue this stalemate. And right now in central Ohio, more than 300,000 people rely on SNAP benefits for food. 10TV's Tara Jabor finds out what's being done to help families who fear they won't receive their benefits next month.
The director here at Broad Street Food Pantry says if SNAP benefits run out, they know that more people will come here for food. But she says she's not sure if they'll be able to keep up with that demand.
Every weekday morning, Broad Street Food Pantry is packed with people picking up free groceries.
Since August, the need has gone up. But it's just remained up.
They serve about 300 families a week, but lately it's been harder to feed those families. The food pantry is receiving less from Mid-Ohio Food Collective because of budget cuts, so they have had to find other ways to get food.
We've also been looking to try to find some wholesalers, people that we can purchase from, but their prices are higher, so then it means we're probably purchasing less.
Kelly Long says the federal government shutdown has been top of mind. She worries families won't get their SNAP benefits, which will send more people to food pantries.
And SNAP benefits, people get an average of like $190 a month per person. There's no way food pantries can make up that difference, and people don't have any place else to turn.
So what is the solution? State Representative Latina Humphrey thinks the state should step up. She introduced House Bill 502 that would have the state pay for SNAP benefits.
That with my bill, we can cover the monthly cost of SNAP, of TANF, of WIC through the rainy day fund. When the government opens back up, we would put that money back.
Representative Humphrey says there is $4 billion in the rainy day fund, and she doesn't want to see Ohio families go hungry.
But this is clearly a rainy day, and we need to do something about this.
And right now, that House bill is still in committee. Reporting in downtown Columbus, Sarah Jabor, 10 TV News.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.